Hello, Register readers. This is Ashley Vance bringing you episode number 3 of Open Season. As usual, I'm joined by Alfresco's Matt AC and Mule Source's Dave Rosenberg. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello. Yeah, go Alfresco.
Still prima donnas after all these years.
Yeah, did we get any successful comments back like that again?
Oh, we did. You know what? I failed to gather them. So, well, let's hold that thought.
Ashley, while we're talking, you've got to go back and pull those because I want the criticism up front and center.
Yeah, I need my enormous ego burst because I don't have enough depression in my life. I need a bunch of numbnuts giving me a hard time about this stupid podcast.
Well, we have no shortage of that, so I'll dig a couple up. And then
Excellent. We
should apologize a little bit for not bringing Mark Shuttleworth through as promised. He's been a very busy man this week, so I'm going to give a 60% chance that we'll have him on next week's show. And with that, maybe we should jump into the big topic du jour, which was Yahoo buying Zimbra.
Bravo to Satish and the others, yeah. Scott, John, and others.
Big congratulations to those guys. It's a major award, and they've won it.
So, Matt, I mean, you position this as what kind of the culmination of this open source gold rush kind of thing?
Oh, well, hopefully not the culmination, but just the beginning of it. The difference is initially I didn't think that Zimbra had the numbers to back up the valuation, and it turns out they don't, but... what they do have is, I mean, so they did, I have this confirmed from an unimpeachable, indisputable source, that they did $6 million last year in bookings, not revenue, but bookings, and they're on track to hit $20 million this year. They'll probably more than double it next year, so... Suddenly, the $350 million, while, you know, a hefty valuation, it's certainly within the realm of reason. And what it tells me is, looking backwards at their business, these guys have done a fantastic job to build a business. And I'm almost convinced that you couldn't do, or it would be extremely hard to do what they've done in the proprietary world. Because you'd have to spend so much money going out there hiring salespeople to try to find people to buy... email. I think it would be a thankless task and a costly task to try to do what Zimbra has done in proprietary software. They could have all the sex appeal they have now, but without the disruptive business model, I think there's no way that they would be bought today by Yahoo or, you know, bought this week by Yahoo for $350 million. It might happen in the future, but without the open source component, I think it would be a long slog for them.
So how much did
There's no way anyone would have ever, they could never have gotten the distribution alone. They never would have become, they would never have gotten adoption had it not been open source.
Well, and how much did the hype, you know, last year, I mean, the hype around Zimbra was about as high as it can get. How much do you think that helped them out, given that, you know, it seemed at least in the press, some of their momentum had died down in the recent months?
Well, I wonder if in part... So I remember that too. You heard about Zimbra. You couldn't eat your breakfast without looking at the back of the box and seeing, you know, a Zimbra giveaway. I wonder if part of the reason it died down was because of acquisition discussions. I mean, I understand that was, you know, last year was a long time ago, but I wonder if in the last few months, certainly in the last few months, I'm guessing that they may have pulled back a little bit on PR.
I don't think so. I don't think so, actually. I think it was all part of the strategy. My guess is it was strategy. I'm going to give them maybe too much credit here. But if you look at the timing of when they were doing the big push, I mean, first of all, they used the PR agency who's known for, like, blanket, you know, total carpet bombing campaigns, who got them, you know, every possible press thing they could possibly do in a really short period of time because they were launching the product. But then if you look at sort of, like, where the product is now, it's their targets have been more about blogs and groups and things like that, about getting users and targeting specifically, like, lots of Mac users, for example, and trying to get the underground momentum. But they haven't had a major product release that's been, you know, sort of newsworthy beyond the initial launch. So I think it actually makes sense.
Yeah, and I'll be honest with you. So I don't know if you've tried, and it is beta software. Actually, I would say it's alpha software. But I don't know if you've tried their Zimbra desktop, but it's not that good. I mean, it has the potential to be very good, but I tried using it. I didn't blog about it because I liked the Zimbra guys too much, but it didn't work. And so I think they've been putting a lot of effort. But having said that, the last few revs have gotten progressively better. So I think they have been putting a lot of effort into the product itself, and they're doing some stuff that's really innovative. The desktop sync is a good idea, and you'll see it crop up in a host of. It's going to turn into a bad pun that I didn't intend, but you'll see it in a host of hosted offerings, people following Zimbra's lead. So I don't know. I think the guys, they did a fantastic job. They deserve every penny of the $350 million. They've done a better job than most open source companies of marketing themselves, because they have been at the nexus of the Web 2.0 hype and the open source hype, and they've profited therefrom. Not only in the payoff from Yahoo, but I mean, it shows up in their sales figures as well. $6 million that's basically their first year of selling product. I know of a few companies in the open source application space they're going to do close to that, or will have done close to that in their first year, but not quite that. I think that they may well earn the prize for biggest first year, and that has a lot to do with their aggressive marketing. So kind of coming back to something that Dave has said for years, there's a lot of things you can go that open source helps lower the costs on. I'm not sure if marketing is one of them. You may not spend your marketing dollars in the same way. You're not doing ads in the Wall Street Journal, for example, but you still need to spend money on marketing. And Zimbra would not be the company that it is today, and would not have been bought by Yahoo this week, but for the fact that it's been fantastically good at marketing.
Which PR company were you talking about, Dave, that worked with them?
I think that they used Outkast.
They use Outkast.
Yeah. And very, you know, that's their MO. Outkast is really good at that. But Outkast also does Salesforce. So you got to kind of look at it from, you know, they have a good domain expertise in these sort of hosted apps, new school kind of things. And they really, I mean, they'll get you in front of 10 or 15 reporters, you know, at the same publication even. So it's an interesting approach. I don't know whether or not it doesn't always make sense for everyone, right? So I think, you know, in my case, it would not be all that helpful to go do that kind of thing, because first of all, we have a stupid company name, but then so did they, actually. But, you know, we're not a GUI. So when you don't have a fancy screenshot, it becomes a different sort of marketing exercise. But I think the other side of this that's interesting is that when you sort of look at why this appealed to Yahoo, they have to compete with Google, right? So if you look at, they have to compete with Exchange and Google and Yahoo Mail. Yahoo has arguably the most users of the portal. And now their offering is significantly better. I don't care what anybody says. Gmail is good, but it's not great. And this is actually far better than Gmail.
Agreed.
And well, they can pay for it and multi-tenant it and all this other kind of stuff. It's a good move. I mean, they'll make that money up in a year.
What does this give Yahoo that they don't have today? Gmail... Google's got all the tie-ins now with their documents and a couple other applications, and then Yahoo just revamped their email. What is this really going to give Yahoo in the long run, I guess?
Go ahead, Dave, and then I'll...
No, you. Well, they made it all widgety.
See, we're not prima domina. We're not prima domina.
So they made it all widgety and fancy, the new mail, but I think what they don't have is that ability to do the enterprise-branded type of stuff. You know, with the private label for my company and that kind of stuff with security and everything else. And we'll talk a little bit later about social contracts. I think, you know, Yahoo, there's not a lot of questions about privacy, and they're very clear about how they use your data or don't use your data. And versus Google, who, you know, if you store your stuff on there, it's kind of like, hey, you know, good luck. You put it here. It's your own goddamn fault. And I think, you know, there's a different level of trust in it. For Yahoo, I think it's a big opportunity that they haven't tapped at all, monetizing the enterprise.
So they're going to go after these corporate accounts. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, yes to that. And there's one other thing that it gives them. So it gives them the entree to the enterprise. Although Zimbra, I think if you were to ask them, they would probably candidly tell you that they're, you know, they don't have gargantuan traction in the enterprise. They do have some marquee accounts like H&R Block and others, but their strength has been more on the ISP side. And I remember talking with John Robb one time, and his point to me was, we're going for the ubiquity. they priced for ubiquity. The model was the distribution model was for ubiquity, and they went after initially it's the Comcast, et cetera, of the world. So that's fantastic for them. And they also do have enterprise traction, and more to the point, they're positioned against the enterprise. So I agree with Dave. It helps Yahoo there. And I think it's a much more interesting play, frankly, than Google's play to the enterprise, because even though, you know, for this podcast we use Google Docs, and for some point uses within my company we'll use Google Docs, it's a very light complement to what we already have. And it, while that complement may take over our use of OpenOffice or Microsoft Office in the future, I'm not holding my breath. And frankly, it's a pretty stodgy, boring approach for a company like Google that has, you know, it's all about shaking up the industry. Coming out with a hosted Microsoft Word is not really all that interesting, frankly. What is interesting, and where more emphasis should be placed, is where we spend most of our time. It's not in PowerPoint, it's not in Word, it's not in Excel, it's in email. And I think if Yahoo and Zimbra can come out with something around email that really shakes up email and lets you do a lot of that Word documents and that sort of thing in email. I mean, you're probably not going to be able to do your spreadsheets and whatnot in email, and you probably never will, but most people don't use spreadsheets, at least not for what they were intended to be used for. I think that makes Yahoo a very interesting enterprise company, and arguably much more disruptive than Google. And even last week, I don't think I would have said that about Yahoo, because I would have clearly put them in second place, in a distant second place. But this, I think, makes them look interesting. The second thing, kind of coming, that was a long way of agreeing with Dave. The second, second thing that I think that this gives them, and you know, Dave and I both have an open source fetish, so take this with a grain of salt. But I do think that this gives Yahoo a great on ramp. And a complementary on-ramp to their hosted offering. So they've got this free distribution mechanism called the Internet, where they just put their apps up on the Internet, and people can subscribe to them or log into them for free or for a paid service. And so that's pretty disruptive. But what happens when you go offline? What happens for all those customers, enterprises in particular, that don't want to have everything hosted? Well, this gives them a way to get there. So the software, the Zimbra software, is diffused throughout the planet through downloads. People install it on their servers. And maybe in some way it connects back to the mothership at Yahoo. But the point is, it gives Yahoo a way to go offline. And that's a really, for me, that's kind of the irony of this, because the one thing that I always would fault Zimbra for was that it tied everything back into the browser, even though it didn't have to, or even if it could have reskinned the browser to look like a fat client app. The fact is, Zimbra was as much about, now with its desktop client, is as much about offline as it is about online. And I think that gives Yahoo an interesting on-ramp or off-ramp, if you will, into the enterprise, because it gives the enterprise what I think a lot of enterprises want, and that is they don't want a 100% hosted model.
Yeah, it's an open ramp. I'll tell you this, though, my one complaint about it is that as a Yahoo, if you didn't use Yahoo early on, every good name is taken. And so, like, I, for example, have, you know, my name at Gmail, but I don't have it at Yahoo.
Right.
And therefore, I don't use my Yahoo Mail.
Maybe you should change your name.
That's not the worst idea. I've thought about it a number of times. I'm thinking about Matt Acey.
So did Red Hat miss out by not jumping in here? Does it make a lot more sense for a service provider to do the email stuff anyway?
You know, Red Hat can't do an acquisition very effectively, so I think they did the right thing by abstaining.
Yeah, I originally said that it would have been a good... It's too bad that they didn't buy Zimbra, but I think that would have been too far afield for Red Hat. MySQL, I think, would be a good acquisition for Red Hat, or something closer to the middleware tier. Actually, I think MuleSource would be a fantastic acquisition for Red Hat. I think lots of the infrastructure, open source infrastructure type layers, or even the systems management, like a Hyperic or something, would be a good play for Red Hat. I don't think Zimbra would have been a good play. Word on the street,
Red Hat
credible word. I was going to say word on the street, and this is a credible word, is that Red Hat did, in fact, talk with Zimbra, but the talks broke down, I think, fairly early on. They broke down.
But Matt, let's think about Red Hat for a minute here. The JBoss acquisition, you know, theoretically makes a lot of sense, right? Company is still having a bit of a struggle, right, with the whole thing. There's a lot of moves in the management layer. There's people coming in, for example, from Metamatrix who are taking on new roles that relate to the JBoss products, which I think are going to present some real challenges. So I don't think Red Hat could effectively absorb another company right now. I mean, if they would buy mine for $500 million, I would say yes, they're the best. But you know, if we look at what would make sense, I think Zimbra, or I think Hyperic is actually a good answer. I think Zimbra would have been a good answer if Red Hat could pull off Oracle type of acquisitions or Cisco type of acquisitions. And it just ain't happening.
Dave, all you're shooting for is $500 million. You've got to build off the ZenSource buy. And
yes,
this Zimbra
right.
buy.
It's just, I mean, that's just, it would have, that'd be the cash component.
Yeah, I mean,
I need that for me. That's just for me.
I think either of your companies we're looking at, it's at least $800 million now.
Oh, dare to dream.
I mean, Matt, in seriousness, though, I mean, if you do look at ZenSource and the Zimbra buy, I mean, the prices, JBoss was kind of an anomaly, maybe. The prices for these open source buys were way higher than what we saw with Oracle grabbing companies last year.
It proves my point, Matt, about there being an open source winner.
It could be.
One market leader.
Well, yeah, maybe. Although maybe it also disproves your point in the sense that has or could Geronimo in the JBoss world, could that come in and resume, take place of the community project out there? So far it hasn't. And let's say, so Zimbra, there's not really a clear second to Zimbra, maybe Open Exchange or something. Maybe that then becomes the community project. The problem is most of these aren't true community projects.
Right,
they're
exactly.
Companies. So it doesn't. But coming back to, actually, what did you ask again? I had an answer for it before Dave rudely interrupted.
Just as far as the valuations going way up with
I think it does jack the valuations up. The difficulty is going to be Red Hat simply can't make these kinds of acquisitions, partly because it has to shepherd its cash a little bit more carefully because it doesn't have the funny money that a Yahoo does or that a Citrix does. You know, and that's one of the blessings and curses of open source. You make money in more responsible ways. And I think going forward at some point in the not too distant future, these same parameters that constrain Red Hat will constrain all companies because everybody is going to have to move to more of this services-based model, whether it's software as a service where, you know, arguably there's still a lot of funny money or open source. And so theoretically the valuation should come down, although I wouldn't hold my breath.
I hope not. I mean, I need them to stay up. You know, there's no question about that. But you see, I think the thing to think about, though, is that what you're buying, those were all different and sort of even weird purchases. Like, I thought ZenSource, I'm happy for those guys, but that was a total irrational exuberance because of the VMware IPO, I think. But Zimbra made a little bit more sense because, you know, you're buying a seasoned management team, you're buying a good product, you're buying a large base of users, you know, you're buying a very successful distribution method. So that one, you can see how you monetize it. I mean, JBoss made a lot of sense too, right? Big user base, lots of distribution, and, you know, the monetization wasn't quite as obvious with JBoss, I think, in terms of what they maybe could do. And Zimbra may or may not be monetizing, but for Yahoo, it doesn't matter. Because as Matt said, Yahoo dollars are, you know, are only worth 30 cents compared to Red Hat dollars.
Yeah, I don't know. To me, the ZenSource one, although it was a lot of money, it makes more sense to me a little bit just because of how much money is at stake in this market. And besides that, it kind of makes Citrix an immediate target as a whole for Microsoft to buy
but there was nothing there, though. That's the thing. That's the struggle. Like, they didn't have a giant user base necessarily. They didn't. The product wasn't evolved, and the team was. I think the engineering team was very good, but you got to kind of wonder the rest of what else we were buying in that company.
Right. Well, there's no question the VMware kind of irrationality boosted the price up, but you know, somebody's got to compete with VMware at some point.
Yeah, good for that. Hey, look, I hope that BEA or TIBCO get bought tomorrow for, you know, some whatever, and then they come along and buy me for the same kind of thing.
So let's switch gears a little bit, even though the Red Hat bashing may continue a little bit.
Look, I think Red Hat. I spent time with Matt Zulick, and I actually I finally, because I actually was sort of negative on Red Hat for a long time, and then having spent a little bit of time with them, you start to really understand the challenges over there, and it's not insignificant. I mean, that's it's a difficult culture. You know, it's an operating system company that became now an app server and now an SOA company. I mean, that's not an easy transition.
Yeah, and I don't hear any bashing here. I just think that there's hard realities that Red Hat is up against. And I'm a big Red Hat fan, so what I hope happens is that Red Hat is the prudent parent sitting back while the Joneses next door load up on Hummers and whatnot that they don't actually need, and that and then, you know, they drown themselves in debt and they all go out of business. You know, that's kind of what you, for the Red Hat supporter in me, that's kind of what I hope, is that all these companies are being foolish. The downside of it is, however, and I wrote about in this blog post, the open source diaspora, is that you've got, I think Tim O'Reilly, I originally said he was wrong, but I think he's probably right, that proprietary companies are going to be the ones that buy up most of the open source companies. And what does that mean for the open source ecosystem? Well, hopefully what it means is that Zimbra within Yahoo will help push Yahoo to an even stronger support for open source. And I think Yahoo's been, with Hadoop and with other things, they've actually been increasingly good open source citizens. So you hope that that's what it means by these proprietary companies buying open source companies. What unfortunately it may mean, however, is that all the momentum behind these open source companies will kind of die once they go into these big proprietary companies. I mean, frankly, going back to Geronimo, when's the last time you heard about Geronimo? I mean, it was hard to hear. It was hard to. It was you never heard about it before the IBM acquisition, but you hear even less about it now that it's been consumed through Glue Code into IBM. You just never hear about it. It's non-existent.
Yeah, but why is that? Is it because the community of developers fell off, right? So the user base may or may not have ever been there, right? But the guys who are doing the development either moved on to other projects or whatever else. So I actually think, you know, Geronimo or any of these things are probably examples, but I think for every product that gets acquired or dies or whatever else, you're going to find three or four other companies kind of right away. Look at JBoss, you know, what OpenSpan came out of there, and LoopFuse, and there's other guys that have moved on to like Pentaho and these other companies. So I don't know. I don't think it's out of the question that it spawns more.
What do you guys think will come out of the whole Microsoft, the antitrust decisions that have come out of Europe as far as the open source community in the long haul? I mean, these commissioners were saying they want to chisel Microsoft's market share down to 50%, you know, which was pretty strong language, I thought.
It's pretty shocking, actually, for a bunch of bureaucrats. I mean, I'm no fan of Microsoft, but I think it's inappropriate for the government to go in and try to engineer the market. And you know what, frankly, as to your question, I don't think it means anything, because open source doesn't need government bureaucracy to help it out. It's doing just fine without anybody in Europe and without anybody in the U.S. federal government doing anything to help it out. I mean, what is it great when Brazil and these countries go out there and say we want to give open source at least equal footing in our purchasing decisions? Absolutely. That sort of thing helps. But for this, you know, the antitrust thing, Microsoft's not going to lose because of some bureaucrat's antitrust stipulation. It's going to lose because open source is a better business model and customers buy into it.
Yeah, I couldn't believe what those guys were saying either. And I mean, what do they expect? They're just going to force people to use Linux and Mac OS X?
That's interesting about it. Yeah, what happens then if somehow it all becomes RHEL Linux and that becomes a problem? It doesn't make any sense. The whole thing didn't make a lot of sense to me. But the thing that I think is interesting is that if you look at it from the perspective of, well, what if Microsoft somehow changes the operating system for the sake of argument, and then it becomes open or more extensible or whatever else, or just not as, let's say, monopoly closed? Does that then solve the problem, and therefore they take those comments away about the 50% thing? You know, it seems very knee-jerk, you know, abrasive, which of course I am too. I think Microsoft are arguably the most evil company on the planet still when it comes to open source.
And you guys were talking about Red Hat's response to all this. I actually missed it because I've had my head down at Intel Developer Forum. So what was Red Hat's
head down on the table? they had two press releases that went out. I'm going to find them for you right now. One the day of and one the day after that said, hey, look, we don't think they went far enough with their interoperability. They had the first one was Red Hat delivers statement on decision, basically along the lines that great news for innovation and customer choice, our business interoperability, blah, 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 critically important. And then they next day they come back with another one saying Red Hat advocates true interoperability. So they're congratulating the European Commission, but you know they're saying that the interoperability information and the ability to provide the technologies are key to the competitive landscape, which I think is right. But you know, so their comment is that Microsoft is denying open source providers access to specific interoperability information, which is true. And so Microsoft's response was that they're not going to provide access to certain protocols, for example. Specifically, what's interesting is that it's all this focus on the media player and that kind of stuff, but they're actually not going to provide, or they don't want to provide interoperability information for specific protocols around things like system integration or, you know, web services or whatever else, and even other types of protocols related to networking, because it's too exposed, it exposes too much of the operating system. Which number one says there's a major design flaw in the operating system. Not that we didn't know that. But, you know, I think what Red Hat is saying is, hey, look, it's fine to go after them for the media player, but what happens when we want to do networking between the two operating systems?
So, I mean, I always get the feeling that we're dealing with this Microsoft question 10 years too late. I mean, obviously, if they had done something a little more quickly, it would have been a big deal on the desktop. So when we're talking about this interoperability stuff, I mean, is this still a big deal, or are we kind of dealing with an old question? It's time for the open source guys just to get on with it.
The open source guys can never just get on with anything. As one of them, I can tell you that. I think we're 10 years too late, no question about it. But if you look at some of the things, like you have to look at the way our operating system design changed, and you know all this stuff. So I mean, if you looked at even some of the basics around Unix, it always made a lot more sense versus how the way Windows was built. And even things that were proprietary, like Irix and Solaris before it went open source and all this other kind of stuff, it had a design element that was, you know, sort of relative to having interoperability, and Windows never had that. And so the challenge now is that we're all sort of, people are paying the price for it, basically.
So moving to one of the other biggest companies in the tech market these days is Google, and there's kind of rumors afoot that they may be working on some kind of their own open source license or their own take on licensing, and Chris DiBona is apparently spearheading this effort, and I asked him for comment on these rumors, and I was sent over to the PR department, which gave me what's known as the Apple kick to the groin, which is a no comment. Google's PR, they're like mimicking Apple's PR these days. Do you guys have any sense as to, I don't know, well, if you've heard any rumbles about what's going on over there?
Well, the only thing that I've seen is Chris's comment on the OSI's license discuss, where he says, where if in fact it's the case that Google is coming out with a license that would govern code that it runs on its servers and whatnot, I think it'd be fantastic. What's kind of confusing to me is Chris says in his post, if you view the variety of open source licenses as social contracts, that they become so much easier to deal with, they become simple even. This is actually one of our guiding principles for compliance at Google. Do what the license, even if you think they're a contract, whatever, do what the license requires, for sure, but try to learn what drives the creators of the open source software we use, meaning when they release the code to better know whether they're going to blah, 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 blah. So as I read that, it's to me says Google's guiding principle is to comply with the spirit of open source licenses, even if the letter doesn't require them to give back. And I hope that what he means is that's aspirational for Google, because they certainly haven't lived up to that that spirit of open source licensing, or there'd be a heck of a lot more contributions from Google coming back to the community, because they've heavily modified Linux, they've heavily modified Apache and scads of other open source programs, of which we know some, and many others of which we know little. If in fact that's what he's trying to push at Google, I think that's fantastic, and I think it's the right thing to do. And if they're trying to come out with a license that would basically live up to that spirit of giving back, then that's great too. But we do have some licenses like Larry Rosen's open software license that already do that. And maybe Google should just try releasing code under those licenses. And maybe it should also try releasing back a lot of the software that, that they've already modified. I mean, and they would say, nobody needs our modifications to Linux because they're so special. But as not we've talked point. About before, that's not the point. That's not their prerogative to decide. And frankly, I bet Yahoo would love the modifications they've made. And I bet Google would love the modifications that Yahoo has made. And they're in Dig and Facebook and these other companies would love it too. So it's, so anyway, I'm supportive of what he's apparently saying. I'm just, if you look at Google's track record, A, do they want to be seen to care about open source? Yes, they've got the Summer of Code and these other things. Do they in fact give back line for line of code that they take and modify? Absolutely, they do not, and they don't even come close. So, if this
there
again
another quote, Matt, about the GPL, like if we found something with GPL, we would just write it out or whatever it was.
Yeah, no, yeah. He definitely said that. I've, yeah,
actually, that was at OSCON. I was at the presentation where he said that. Yeah, he said Google would just anytime they run into a restriction in a license they don't like, they have the engineering, you know, money and might to just write around any problems and do the code themselves.
Yeah, that's a, you gotta really wonder then how this affects these comments about this license. It doesn't. It wouldn't pretend to be a positive.
Yeah, and I kind of brought these rumors up. We don't know that Google is for sure working on this license, but what I have heard is that they're internally debating, you know, being a big trendsetter in open source licensing and. Somehow they want to make it easier, and so it sounds like they definitely are.
I think that would be welcome. I mean, you know, putting some, they've got enough sort of clout and dollars and everything else that they could potentially fix a lot of things. But we'll see what happens.
But you know, you look at Yahoo now with the Zimbra buy on top of their Hadoop stuff, and I mean, aren't they a bigger friend of the open source community at this point than Google?
Yahoo, I thought, had always been a fairly big friend of the open source community. I mean, they were. I think that struggles, though, is you have to look at early on, Yahoo was built on all on FreeBSD. It wasn't built on Linux. And so they never had that sort of development arm like Linux had, and that surge. But I don't really know anything else about their infrastructure at this point, so I couldn't even tell you what they're using. But I got to assume there's lots and lots of open source in there.
And so maybe before we shift to our part of the program where we give helpful open source business advice, maybe Dave, you could you bring us through MuleSource's announcement from this week?
Our Mule on Demand.
Yes.
Ashley, while he's doing that, get the letters,
right?
The
yes.
comments back.
Matt and I will talk amongst ourselves. Let's talk about so what we launched is a Mule on Demand, which is basically a integration layer in the cloud. So all of the functionality that's available in Mule and in the bus will be available over the internet. So you can send transactions out to this server in the cloud, and it'll take them and pass them to the other side and do transformations and all sorts of wacky things. But the question I have is why Alfresco doesn't offer a hosted offering at this point?
The main reason being that go out and try to find a successful example of hosted content management. You won't find very many. In fact, you won't
Fair
find
enough.
Any.
Is that because it's not a? Is that there's not a stable enough product set, or is it because it's just you have too many files internally and you couldn't
yeah,
really?
I don't know. We've talked about it. In fact, I mean, we do have some hosting partners, so you can actually get Alfresco hosted. It's just not many people that want it. I think as we go, as we are actively developing more of the collaboration features in Alfresco, and that'll be coming out in our next release, those parts, kind of the more SharePointy spin on Alfresco, that I think will have some uptake and hosted. But having said that, the numbers that I have on Microsoft SharePoint, which I think would be, you know, I'd put out there as the most successful hosted offering, and it's the vast majority of SharePoint implementations aren't hosted. It's on premise.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It doesn't seem to fit the market very well.
Well,
and you've had,
well, it's interesting. You know, the question I would have is that why has that market not shifted? Whereas if you look at CRM, for example, and even now ERP and stuff like that, why wouldn't document management shift, or content management, however you want to talk about it?
I don't know.
All right. Well, so, you know, we launched this thing as a test run with Salesforce.com because we thought that there was a, an interesting market there. But really, the right answer for us is that when you look at the SOA ideas, you know, you have these silos of information, and pretty much every on-demand app is a silo. Now, I went to Dreamforce this week, which is the other thing we should talk about, and I walked away so depressed. First of all, I think events just depress me. But the whole thing about the Salesforce.com being the only company that it has all these satellite little hangers-on, like the big shark and, you know, those weird little fish that attach themselves, those sucker fish, I feel like stamping sucker across everybody at Dreamforce because you can pretty much see that they didn't matter, you know, because they were never going to get acquired by Salesforce and they were never going to have enough revenue to truly be relevant. It was a very bizarre thing, but it also made me, when I looked at the other people who we would potentially be competing with in that space, so, you know, there's companies I'd never even heard of. There was one called Boomi, B-O-O-M-I, which was a sort of cool, like, front-end app. And you look at it and you say, maybe these guys can ever, ever, in the next 5 years, get up to $10 million in revenue versus, you know, going against TIBCO or BEA. And I just think to my, I thought to myself, as soon as I got in there, I was like, well, if this is my competition, I don't want any part of this market. And that was an enormous sort of realization about the whole SaaS marketplace right now.
Yeah, I like your approach to product launches, man. You go all out and then you have this reflective period where you think...
Yeah, I'm like, this sucks. Well, but we so we solve a problem. So I still think we're doing the right thing, right? Because we the universe, if you will, needs to solve this problem. And so the bigger picture is not about Salesforce.com. It's that, you know, when you look at things like global exchanges and doing EDI and that old school type of stuff, there's one big company called GXS, which was a GE company. I think it's a GE company again now that did, I think they did nearly $500 million last year, and they're on target for doing something like $800 million this year. And all they do is broker transactions between different people. And they can only do it through a few different file formats and, you know, some specific things. And they definitely have some very sophisticated stuff, but a lot of really just dumbed down kind of crap. And basically what we looked at was like, well, we already can do 40 times more or whatever it is, you know, 40 different transformations and accept transactions from different types of systems and whatever else that they can't do. And so we just started looking at it as like there's an opportunity here for the market, but it also speaks a lot more to how the way people are designing systems these days. And we have a cool flying mule on the Mule on Demand site if you haven't seen it. And that alone was worth all the effort.
So you have learned from Zimbra. There's your sex appeal, flying donkeys.
Exactly. Done and done.
So I checked our email and comments, and we actually did better than I thought. They ranged from positive to just kind of some nice, intelligent feedback. The only one that was slightly critical was, I feel good. That was a nice nap. When's the next show?
You know, I think it's amazing people don't just turn it off. You know, you could just hit stop.
Wait, so the guy last week said, what did he say? Something like, if I have a hangover or no.
I think it was mostly if he, you know, basically if he needed his stomach pumped listening to YouTube.
Okay, so we've got stomach pumped and now we've given somebody
sleep apnea.
Yeah. That's actually a good thing. I feel like we may have done some good. I don't get enough sleep. And if
this
we have helped that person,
we helped a guy with a stomach ache or
you're
put
welcome.
Somebody else to sleep.
Yeah. You're welcome. You're welcome, people out there.
The NyQuil of open source.
That's our new tagline. It's perfect.
And then another guy, actually, he provided a kind of a nice lead in to, you know, our helping open source business kind of segment. He said, I think one of the problems with open source is that the business model isn't very well understood by management types. As a techie, I understand the idea, but it needs to be explained in a way that the pointy-haired bosses understand. Business models, ROI, TCO, and that kind of thing, rather than copyleft, GPL, and free beer. And, I mean, Dave, you kind of touched on some of that stuff before, just especially
But the business model is you somehow need to make money. That's the whole thing. In order to sustain, and then that's pretty much it. But yeah, I mean, we definitely get bogged down in the intricacies of all this crap that's only interesting, you know, within the community of users. And I mean, not that it's not important, but it certainly is not relevant to 99% of the people who are going to consume the software. So the things that I sort of think about, and Matt also, by the way, has an obsession with licensing, which I don't share.
The things that I think are interesting that you have to sort of think about is, you know, what's the mechanism that you're getting your software out there? How can you make money from it? What's the sustainable revenue? Not just how do I make money once? So, you know, professional services were very hip for a while there. And there's a bunch of analysts who were saying open source is about services, but it's not. It's about, it's a, you know, in our case and in most people's cases right now, it's about the subscription and having a relationship with the customer that makes them want to give you money, right? So they, you need to have software that works. You need to have something in place that makes a customer comfortable both with you and that you're going to be continue living on as a corporation, but also that you can offer them something that they can't do themselves. And I think that that's the biggest thing. And then to be able to do that on a sustained basis is the key to success.
Haven't you said, though, that even at the large companies, it's still kind of difficult to just explain to them, you know, you're going to get this software and you're going to pay for service, and they're just still struggling with the whole model?
You know, oddly enough, it's actually, I found it's changed a little. Matt, maybe you have some perspective. The whole idea, people now understand sort of dual licensing a little bit more, that mm-hmm. when you're downloading open source and, okay, that's that version, but when you come to the company, essentially what you're doing is you're, even though the software and largely is exactly the same, you're now buying something that gives you a guarantee, basically. And that's, and it's not so much about insurance as I think it is about, I now have a relationship with a corporation that provides the software versus, you know, potentially some dudes in sandals with ponytails. Matt, back me up on this.
No, I agree.
And so that's gotten easier. And I think people have gotten a lot smarter about this too. So, I mean, despite all the crap and the FUD and everything else, you know, IT executives have gotten much smarter. Procurement companies, your procurement groups now understand how the licensing works. And really, you know, again, you're buying a subscription. So it's not that hard to figure out. Like I, you know, say, it's almost the same argument as I was buying on demand. I'm consuming software in a different way. It's exactly the same thing. So I think we as an industry have to get better about this. And we've actually even talked about this. Matt and I have with whole large groups of other open source companies, and in typical fashion, nothing happens. but it is getting better. And certain companies have done a lot for that. Like MySQL has made it easier for a lot of people, as has JBoss. I mean, JBoss, being that there wasn't so much of a license component, it was just about the support subscription. It's a known entity at this point. And MySQL, certainly with the dual license, has been hugely helpful.
Matt, where are you saying there's some kind of dichotomy between where the open source companies seem to be used right now, whether it's a medium-sized enterprise versus kind of the large-scale enterprise guys?
Well, there is, and I don't know how to explain it. So I know from talking with Dave that MuleSource's customers tend to be Global 2000. Alfresco's customers tend to be Global 2000 and always have been from day one. I mean, our first five customers were all brand names that you'd recognize, and I don't know why that is. And it's not necessarily any better than, say, Sugar CRM that started with, which now is getting quite a few Fortune, even Fortune 50, but Fortune 500 customers, and is doing a fantastic job now in that market. But if, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, it was all SME, and Jaspersoft and a range of Open Bravo, Compere, a range of these companies do a lot of their business, maybe most of their business, with SMEs. And again, that's not a bad thing. I mean, actually, I wish we had a bigger volume of customers from that sort of market, because, you know, then if one of them doesn't renew, that's $5,000 out of your top line for the next year. But if, you know, if you're dealing with these bigger companies and the contracts are bigger, then it's a bigger deal if somebody doesn't renew. So there are blessings and curses from it. But I don't understand why some companies have had one customer demographic and the others have another.
I can address this. I think it has a couple of things. The biggest one for me is it depends on where the software lives within the stack, you know, in your enterprise, and how, first of all, how close it is to transactions, how close it is to dollars, and then how sort of deeply integrated it is with business process. So if you take, for example, and I'll actually use Alfresco, the greatest company on earth, as the example of this, it does actually make a lot of sense to me when you think about something that's going to touch every single department. Content management is going to be that versus something like, say, CRM or even reporting. And it's similarly, it's why when I started looking at different business models and companies and everything else, if you look at EAI, you know, traditionally very expensive. It touches every part of a business, and therefore people are going to be more likely to pay for it because it's touching, you know, you got the family jewels basically, versus you can start CRM kind of outside of this whole thing. And so what Matt said is also the other thing I'd mention is that we have, not that I'm touting tooting my horn, but we have 7 of the Fortune 50, and they're all really bleeding edge early adopters. And so I think that that's a big shift, and it seems to be unique to the U.S., where the big companies have really gone out on a limb with their IT stuff and have started to look at things that, because, you know, they can, despite what Nick Carr says, you can get an advantage for at least, you know, whatever it is, a year or whatever it might be. But really, I think what we're seeing is people are doing a much better job about architecting their future versus things in the past. And we don't see that so much in Europe, and we don't see it at all in Japan, for example.
And then as part of this whole discussion, you know, I think it was Matt, you were going to bring up maybe this transition from, you know, getting a download to actually finalizing a deal. Do you have any advice for other open source companies on that front? I don't know if that was you or Dave that wanted to.
I think it should be Matt. Matt's good at that.
Yeah, well, I mean, so we just, first of all, I think any open source company has to use demand generation software of some kind. And it doesn't, I mean, I have personal bias there because of open source and because of an advisory role I play with LoopFuse. But whether it's LoopFuse or Eloqua or somebody else, open source companies are data companies. They're online businesses. They have to do business online and figure out how to scale. And so there are things like that. There are things like asking for registration if people want documentation. You've got to get to know your users as soon as you can, because if you've got, it's great if you have 1 million downloads, and if you know who exactly 5 of those people are, then you've got 5 potential customers, even if you have 1 million downloads, because if you don't have some way of reaching out to all those other people, then you're screwed. So, I mean, there are just a range of different things. We do things like we're just introducing now an evaluation framework. So we found, one thing that we found is that we were reasonably good about turning downloads into leads. We've got several thousand a month. And so the question then became, we'd get these leads in, we'd start working with them. They have the source code, they have the code. And so there wasn't this compelling event to say, you should buy today because otherwise you can't get the code. That's the proprietary hook. If you don't have the code, that's why things like Zimbra and Sugar, they have that hook. If you want these extra features, you got to pay now. And it creates a compelling event. And I think that's why these companies use it. And it's effective. We don't have that. And so we were thinking, well, how do we get people to get through their evaluation quicker, more quickly, or have a better experience during their evaluation? Because I'm assuming MuleSource is similar. You can say, go take the product and run with it, but somebody downloads Alfresco and you've got an app and you actually have a UI on it. But what do you do next? I mean, do you load 1,000 documents in, 1 million documents in? What do you do with them at that point? So there was nothing that kind of walked them through how to extract value from the system. And so we are creating, we're about to release this evaluation framework that has things like top 10 things to do with Alfresco, with little how-tos and videos that show how to do these 10 things in Alfresco. Then we have other exercises that they can do. And interestingly, we have these, or rather we are tying these things into our Eloqua system so that they will be, people will be able to go back and we'll be able to track. They say that they're interested. We've listed them as a 60% likelihood of closing this quarter. But how do we really know that, you know, they're progressing? Well, we know because they've done X, Y, and Z. How do we know that? Because they've hit these pages in the course of going through their evaluation. So we're mapping the evaluation to specific activities on the web, so that we can track their progress. Is that big brotherish? Maybe, but you know, given all that we're giving away, and given that we're very transparent, or will be transparent when we roll this out as to what we're doing, I think it's a very small price to pay for heck of a lot of free software that you'd be paying millions of dollars for that you're getting for free. And the only thing that we ask is that you help us to understand how well your evaluation's going. It's good, and it's I'm convinced it'll work for us, Dave.
See, what you're talking about is marketing, right? I mean, this is the big thing, right? As going from a project to a product or whatever else, or even as a company evolves, what Matt's talking about is good marketing, right? So fairly sophisticated, but you know, being data driven is all the same stuff that typically engineers aren't used to doing this, and so. Excuse me, when you look at the companies that have been successful so far, if you look at JBoss, for example, and Bob Bickle was obsessive about the Eloqua stuff, and you look at some of the other guys who are doing well, like another company who's doing this very successfully is Hyperic, as example, and they're using LoopFuse, which we are also using. So, you know, this is the struggle, and Matt and I had gone to a bunch of meetings about a year and a half ago or so, or it was actually probably a little bit longer, and, you know, we were open source guys, and they kept expecting us to walk in with ponytails, and we were trying to explain, no, he went to law school, and I went to business school. It's, you know, open source is not just about writing software anymore. It's about how do we create the best piece of software out there, and it has not entirely always to do, you know, with the bits. It has to do with how do we actually make this better.
In all fairness, though, Matt studied under Larry Lessig, so.
Yeah, so it's just so useless. I only learned two things in business school. I agree. And one of them was don't do a business with inventory. So there you go, software. But you know what? Speaking of which, as a total side topic, has anybody looked at the Microsoft, the way that they do their financials related to selling Windows?
What, with the revenue a million years into the future?
Yeah, well, it's amazing, isn't it? That to me says that there's a giant tax thing there that they have to get hit with at some point or other. But they book the revenue when it hits the store shelves, not when it hits a consumer.
Yeah, I mean, I think people have complained about how Microsoft breaks things down for a long time, but
it's pretty amazing. So here's one other thing that Matt touched on that I think is pretty interesting, and that's about the renewal stuff. So we are really aggressive with our customers, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but if it's a renewal time and, you know, we're going in and saying, hey, look, have you taken advantage of our support lately? Have you seen this kind of stuff? Let's make sure that you're happy. This, it is a pretty big risk for the bigger companies. So, I mean, this, I think, is a threat for Red Hat with some of the Wall Street stuff and whatever else, that these are pretty substantial deals that they have to maintain. And if the value, even Red Hat is known as a very good service provider, but if the value isn't perceived there, and for the sake of argument, you decide to cut half of your subscriptions, it's a substantial hit. And that's, I think, something that's underestimated. And part of that is because open source as a business sort of idea hasn't been around long enough for most of us to figure this out.
Is there anything else you want to touch on there, Matt?
No, just to reiterate again that there are lots of things that open source companies can be doing, and frankly, proprietary companies should be doing, to better move prospects along from that initial download to conversion. And you know, the proverbial MySQL's 1 in 1,000 will buy from us. You know, we can do a lot better than that. And I think MySQL is actively looking about how to improve on that, and they're doing a lot better on that with their advisory service and whatnot. And it's, you don't have to be a passive recipient of money in an open source business. What you have is potentially millions of leads in the form of downloads, and the trick is turning those downloads into dollars in a way that's non-invasive and is transparent to the end user, so that they get value from your interactions with them. And I think go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you if you thought, I mean, you know, we never ever talk about Novell except for to talk smack about them. And same thing with Sun. You know, I have no visibility into anything these guys are doing, but I have no idea if they're running programs that are successful or anything else. I mean, certainly Novell seems like no. But it would be interesting to maybe if we can get somebody from there at some point to talk to us as well about what they're doing to encourage people to pay them for the software.
We're going to have Jonathan Schwartz. He's agreed to come on in middle of October to end of October, so we could.
Oh, we'll do that one at the Sun office then, Ashley. Me and you, we're going there.
We can do that. Yeah, I think with Sun, Open Solaris was, I mean, it got a lot more interesting the last 6 months than it had been. For a variety of reasons, just the developer community seems to really have gotten behind it. And you see the Linux guys are kind of bashing Open Solaris a lot, which I think is a pretty good sign for Sun, because it means the people are paying attention to them, and the Linux guys are feeling a little pressure from some of the features Sun's put into OpenSolaris, and then you see IBM agreeing to ship the OS across, you know, it's x86 systems. That's a lot more interesting than it used to be, but I don't know if this will, how much revenue it'll turn into for Sun in the long run.
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, it's done well for them so far. What did they announce in the last quarter, Jonathan? Or maybe this came out in my interview with them. At any rate, I mean, it's all public information. I think they're, as they started giving away all their software, software revenues were up 13%
year. Yeah, but I never quite understand how they, because they don't really break out software revenue.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll take him at his word. And I think, I mean, Jonathan Schwartz has given me profound respect for Sun, or at least for him, and has made me take Sun seriously again, because a year ago, Sun was doing some interesting things with open source, but they were still, you know, they were a novel, a company whose time had come and gone, and maybe they were doing some nice things here and there, but they weren't all that relevant anymore. But Sun is increasingly becoming a relevant open source player, and not just an open source player, but an enterprise software player again. And I think that they can pull it around. I mean, because Jonathan, I think, is right to focus on adoption first. If Sun software isn't widely adopted, it just doesn't matter what they charge for it, how they sell it, etc. They've got to get it out there and get it used. And I think they're doing a good job of that. And to the extent that they can do that, they become an interesting company again. And I, for one, would love to see that. I'd like to see a you know, I hate to say it, but a dying company turn itself around with open source, because we have all sorts of companies that try to turn themselves around and make themselves relevant again by open sourcing crap that they have. Sun has actually open sourced some pretty significant code. And if it works, then, you know, that's a success story that I think that we want.
I think what was pretty funny, too, was that right after NetApp filed that lawsuit against Sun over the file system stuff, Sun went out and bought Lustre, which is an open source file system that, again, competes with NetApp on the high end. So it's kind of like, if you didn't like our first file system, here, take this.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it is pretty interesting, because I can't come up with anything. I was actually just looking, anything even remotely interesting that Novell has done in the last 6 months. And they still own the second largest Linux. Well, arguably Ubuntu, but let's say server Linux. You know, SUSE is still a fairly well used piece of software, but they got nothing. You look at Sun, and there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, they beat SCO in court. I guess that was their.
yeah. Well, they didn't really do that. The lawyers did that.
Shining moment. Gentlemen, I think we may be coming to the end. I just wanted to remind everyone, as usual, that they can send email to software@theregister.com. And I wanted to update everyone to know that my Ubuntu laptop has shipped today, some 26 Ooh. Days after I ordered it. So I guess they figured out where to buy that. They figured out where to buy their copy of Ubuntu.
Oh,
I think now they have like one. I've decided they have one CD that they kind of pass around. And just go laptop.
They recorded over like a VA Linux 4.0, something like that. Which, by the way, I found in my house recently a VA Linux, like I think it was 6.1.
Did you guys have anything else you wanted to add in at the end? I know, Dave, we talked about your big news announcement. I guess I'll put a link in to the on demand site.
Yeah, do it, because the picture, the graphic is worth the whole thing. Forget the rest of it. There's a friggin' flying mule. Hello? That's awesome.
And Matt, when's that new platform you were talking about coming out?
What's what coming out?
The new platform.
The new version, the new release.
Oh, of what? Fresco?
Well, you were talking about that, your kind of framework, right? The development.
Yeah, I'd be interested in that too, Matt.
I'm drawing a blank. Are you talking about the next version of Alfresco?
Yeah, no, the Alfresco framework for the evaluating thing.
That should be. So the U.S. Alfresco sales engineering team is working on that right now, and I'm expecting it at least an initial stab at it by the end of this month.
And
that'll just be online for anybody to do, or do you have to sign up for it?
No, it'll be online for anybody to use, but I'm assuming you'd have to to come in and give your information in some way, because we are a data-driven company. So
absolutely.
Well, gentlemen,
but, I'll let you know how it goes. I mean, because the idea behind it is right. Whether or not it actually works is something else entirely. But I'm optimistic.
One other thing to follow up on from last time was we talked about hiring and such, and I actually hired 3 sales guys in the last month. So, you know what's worked? I know, exactly. The network effect is the best thing that you can possibly have. So the more people who found out about the company and whatever else, the more people were finding. I also just saw that Intalio just raised some more funding. There hasn't been any big funding news lately. That's another interesting thing. We'll talk about that next time, maybe.
Did you guys still have job openings that need filling? It's more sales guys and...
No more sales guys.
No more sales guys.
Yeah, a company goes horribly. Everything becomes difficult to manage once you have sales guys. Correct me, back me up on that one, Matt.
That's true. We're looking for community lead, somebody to work actively in our community. We're looking for a little bit of everything. So,
and HyperX still hasn't taken us up on our Wii challenge either.
I thought you'd scheduled that in for sure.
I think they're ducking me. They're ducking us at this point. So I don't know if Javier listens to this, but, you know, I'm just calling him out as a punk right now.
And as always, you guys can go to theduckrabbit.com to buy my thrilling new book. I think I managed to sell like 6 or so off the show last week, so I'm going to stick with this.
Nice. Very nice. Did it ship? Because I ordered mine.
It has not shipped.
By the way, since we have a few extra seconds, and it has nothing to do with open source, but... I have Adblock installed in Firefox, and I keep hearing about how it's the death of all commerce on the internet and whatnot, but I can't actually, it doesn't seem to block any ads on, and I have it turned on. I must be doing something wrong, but if an alert user or listener out there who's not asleep or pumping their stomach at this point has any ideas on how to get it working, I would appreciate it, because I cannot get this bloody thing working.
Just please.
I can't
don't.
Figure it out either. I gave up on it too. So you're not the only one. Maybe it's the Mac.
Thank God. I think, you know, let's just leave the ad block and the register out of this.
Exactly.
Oh, wait. You know what? I just installed a filter while we were talking here, and that filter seems to have worked.
Next time, we also have to talk about the Mozilla thing, which I think is very interesting.
Actually,
I'm into that.
You know what? Let's do that real quick, just since the 400 million download number came out.
It won't be relevant for very long because they're probably at 600 million by now.
What do you guys think? The project's being managed well overall or not so much?
I think it's being managed well. I think they do a good job.
Well, the question is, do they think it's being managed well because they're looking for a new executive director?
Yeah, I think I saw some spam email about that.
Yeah, I did too, actually. Well, what about but they also, the Thunderbird thing was also the fact that they're spinning out Thunderbird as its own business unit, I think is pretty cool. It's its own investment. That's a good idea.
I think that all of these projects, I've become a believer after talking with Mike at Eclipse. I think Eclipse is the right model for these projects that sit between commercial and community that really can't be 100% community and shouldn't be 100% commercial. Eclipse offers a fantastic way to merge the best of both worlds. I think Firefox and Thunderbird on the email side, those are both ripe. And frankly, OpenOffice is another one that should be managed in that way. Sun needs to let OpenOffice go free and manage it in Eclipse in an Eclipse sort of model, where you have all these companies that are sponsoring projects. I think that these projects would be the better for it. And it's not to say that Mozilla has been poorly managed, because I think Mitchell has done a fantastic job there. I just think that there's a lot of... I mean, Firefox should be a bigger commercial presence. Right now, it's being adopted by a bunch of... It's me downloading it rather than IBM shipping it with all of their add-ons to it and whatnot. And it really should be, I think, the latter. It should be both a community project and something that commercial companies can get behind. And I don't think it's there yet. And I think that's in part because of the way it's managed. It's managed well, but it's just managed, I think, differently from how it should be.
And if you look at Thunderbird, you know, in terms of having Outlook blows. And the only thing it really has going for is the integrated
sort of system, right? So you've got calendaring and everything in there, but that's not that difficult. And so the fact that Thunderbird is now going to get spun out, those are the kind of features that people are going to crank out very quickly. And I think we'll see a lot of innovation. It's just going to further, it's going to give people more options. And Thunderbird isn't bad to begin with, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah, it is.
It has a lot more to do there.
It's horrible.
Oh, come on. It's not that bad.
The worst thing they ever did was, I'm a Eudora fan, and I cringe to think what they're going to do with my precious Eudora.
Well, you know, using Mac Mail is not great either, and I'm using that. So it's still better than Outlook, though. I mean, you know, if you want to really start playing some fun games, try to install, like, the Salesforce or Sugar connector for into Outlook. That'll take up an afternoon for you.
the search in Thunderbird, though, you can, like, never find the mail that you're looking for.
I don't know. I don't have that problem. I had pretty good success with it. The reason I stopped using it was because when OS X, whatever version it was, came out, it wouldn't index the messages correctly. And so you couldn't search in the file system of your mail. You could only do the Apple Mail. So I switched back to that.
Right. And then, well, Matt, what were you talking about with OpenOffice? Because, so you think Sun should, what, just not support them financially? I mean, IBM, Symfony, basically, they've taken the OpenOffice stuff. So.
Well, IBM getting involved balances it out a little bit. But Sun right now does 90% of the development on OpenOffice. And it's some enclave in Germany that does all the work. And so if you talk with Michael Meeks at Novell or any of these people outside of Sun, they'll tell you that it's not an open community. It's heavily managed by Sun, and, you know, you could say rightfully so, it's theirs, but for an open source project, no, the answer is no, it's not rightfully so. It should be otherwise. IBM's gotten involved, and they've, I think, thrown 35 developers on it, and that's great, but that'll kind of de facto shift the balance a little bit. But at the end of the day, all the committers are at Sun, then it's not going to help a lot. So I think they need to go to a more open model, and I would vote for Eclipse, an Eclipse type model for OpenOffice.
One of the things we have to ask Mr. Schwartz about is, didn't they announce support for Windows like a week ago? They were going to start shipping.
Yeah.
What the hell is that?
I mean, this is, since Schwartz taken over, he's pretty much just gone through making friends one by one with all the guys that McNeely used to piss off. I think Sun's been supporting Windows on their servers for the last, like, I want to say 2 or 3 years. Now it's just more that you can actually get it as an option. Before, they would kind of support it if somebody really wanted it.
It's interesting. I mean, it definitely is a giant shift over there.
Well, and it's also part of their, like, virtualization strategy, I think, because they're going to have this new hype. They have a hypervisor project called Project Virginia, where they're going to do server and networking and storage virtualization from one spot, and part of that's going to be managing Windows servers. So I think this all fits into that big interoperability agreement they signed when they settled the antitrust stuff, I think.
Interesting.
So, but I mean, it is a huge shift. They've gone with the Intel chips, they've gone to support Microsoft, and it seems like they almost have better relationships with Microsoft than Red Hat these days. Which is...
I would say yes.
So we shall see. Yeah, we'll definitely ask him about that, and hopefully we will have Mark Shuttleworth on next week. If not, you'll hear our dulcet tones once again. Thank you, gentlemen, for episode 3.